Accession number 9420, Reel 2.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 2. You were telling me about the career structure in the railway yards and how it was affected by the...
Well, yes, it was severely affected because of the call-up, as most industries were. And, of course, it used to be an all-male set-up in the railways then, and women were out of the question except for in the offices. But, of course, when the call-up took place, it affected the cleaners, first of all, because they were they occupied a job that could be done by any of either sex. And, of course, the result was, inevitably, as it was in the factories, they called women up to do the cleaning, and when the lads got called up. And, of course, there used to be the usual... joking and ribaldry between the men, drivers and firemen, and the cleaning staff. But by and large, I think they did a very good job. They were a happy crowd, you know, as they do in those sort of times when they're on a new job altogether, and they get a sort of camaraderie between them. And it seemed to get the railways out of a spot, which could have been very serious, but of course the women came to the rescue as they did in the ordinary factories.
Were there any women employed at all in the actual repair yard, engine repair yard?
No. In the repair shop or the running sheds, except, of course, that the engines, when they were cleaned and came out or came back off their journeys, and had to be cleaned to go out again, normal cleaning, which was more or less cleaning the grease, external grease and dust off the outside of the engine. And that's all it was, really, in the wheels and that. They were in the running shed. They actually operated in the running shed and in the open yards where the lines were, you know, the shunting lines were. But in the our engine repair shop where I operated from, of course, there were no women in there at all.
Was there a shortage of people in the repair shop?
No, they were. It's because they were all craftsmen, you see, in the main, except for us as mates and assistants. And I mean, except there were no labourers there except the sweepers out.
So they were all exempt from call up.
Yes, they were.
There was only the boilermakers, mates and things like that were...
Fitters and boiler mounters and blacksmiths and all these various crafts, which I later organised into the union when I went back after the war. And, of course, they were exempt. They had to be because they've got to keep the railway lines running because of the transit of goods and trucks and arms and so forth.
You mentioned the union. At this time... did you get involved in the unions during the 3 or 4 months?
No, the union, the shop there when I went in wasn't organised, and I wasn't there long enough anyway to take an interest in it because I was only there a few months, wasn't I? You see, I went in onto the railway in April 17, and I was on my way then. I was 17 then, you see. No, I wasn't. I wasn't 17 until October.
Were you political at all at this time?
No. The only... actually, there was no time for politics. Everybody was taken up with the war, you see, and the war was the only thing that mattered then, because everybody's life was being affected by the war. We were getting casualties, and there were these telegrams were coming saying that we regret to inform you, you know, that your son is missing, presumed dead, or was killed in action, etc., etc. and neighbours all round, you know, were getting these messages, and it became more or less commonplace. You know, it wasn't so frequent because it was scattered all over the country, obviously. But every week you would, or fortnight, you would hear somebody had received a telegram, some neighbour that you knew or had heard about or was passed on by gossip, you know. That it, and of course, funnily enough, it didn't affect us who wanted to go. You know, there was always a high degree of patriotism.
Did you ever think of joining up early, you know, giving a false age?
No. No, because I was too involved in the work I was doing, actually. You know, I was being young and, you know, that didn't occur to me at all.
Now, could you tell me how you came to join the army then? In 1917.
Well, I was called up for a testing, you see. In,
tell me exactly what happened.
I got an official notice telling me to attest at the Green in Water Lane there, where the recruiting office was. And they said, you'll be hearing from us, you'll get your calling up papers. So I said, OK, you know, I was quite happy about it.
Now, you were tested on the 25th of August, is that right, 1917?
That's right, and then, because that was before my birthday wasn't till October, you see, because I was 17, yeah, I was 17 then, was I, sorry? Yes, that's right, I was 17.
So, after you'd attested, you went back to the railway works?
17. Yes, I went. That was in the course of my employment there, you see. I got me calling up me attestation notice while I was on the railway, and then all I had to do was to wait till I got the call up. So it was, I got called up while I was on the railway in November, I think it was. Early part of November, soon after my birthday. Yes, well, that would be my age, you see. I was 18 on the 4th of October, and of course, I was called up immediately.
What happened when you were called up? What? Firstly, how did your parents react when you were actually called up?
Well, my mother was on her own, and as of the, she just accepted it as, and she knew I wanted to join up. You see, she knew I wanted to go and fight the German sort of business, and so she didn't. She gave me up as hopeless, I suppose, from that angle, like most mothers did. Of course, my brother had been called up before me too, and so she was used to it. She knew that it was inevitable, you know. So,
where did you have to go when you were called up?
The Green, the recruiting office at the Green, and there was a sergeant there with his coloured sash on, red sash. I shall never forget it, because he said, what's your job, son? So I said, oh, Boilermaker's mate. He said, oh, all right, well, you've got to have a medical first. So he said, go in there, and I went in the room, and I had this medical, and I was passed as A1.
Was it a thorough medical? What sort of medical was it?
It was a very thorough medical. Yes, there was quite a number, of course, always there. Continually, day after day, according to their age requirements, you know. And I thought that the medical, I'd never been examined like that before, and of course it was a new experience. That was a new experience for me, and I've always been curious about things, new things, and naturally I was impressed by it, and went back, and they said, you're A1. Because I told you before you went that what category you were in, you're A1 or A2 or B1 or B2 or whatever it was, if you had any ailments or anything, it was all written down very carefully and noted, and you were passed accordingly in that classification. I was pleased to know I was A1, naturally. I did. I felt as fit as a fiddle. I was very fit, you know, throughout using this hammer work on the railway. I was an ideal military subject for infantry. Although they did mention to me about going in the garrison artillery or the guards. He says, you're big enough for the guards. He said, we'll see. And of course, that was the sergeant, colour sergeant, and he didn't have the say-so. It was the higher-ups that had the say-so. And of course, they were guided, as I've since found out, by the amount of casualties and requirements from the infantry and artillery or the various services, you see, as they suffered their losses. They had to be repaired.
You didn't know what unit you'd be sent to? You were
I was just sent.
Did you have a preference?
No. No, you went where you were sent. You did as you were told. Right through that war, I found that. You did as you were told, and I accepted that because you couldn't tell them and their business anywhere. You tried to do it on the railway or any other place you worked for, you see. So I accepted it. And I've always been easygoing from that point of view and taken everything in my stride, and it didn't come amiss.
Did they do any other kind of test, or did they do anything else while you were at the Green?
No, they simply said that you'll have a trade test when you get to... they put me down as a Boilermaker's mate, of course, obviously, which I was, and it's on my military documents. And, of course, when I got to Blackdown, they gave me a trade test, and all it was to just hitting a set with a hammer. You know, a set is a tool that... It's a very massive, enlarged kind of chisel, which is held by a long metal handle, and you hold it on to cut a piece of steel in off or a rivet off, and you have to swing a hammer and hit this without leaving your name and address on the top. And I was a fair hammerman, I suppose, and I didn't leave my name, but in spite of that, they just simply put me straight in the infantry, you know, the third.
So you were sent to Blackdown Camp. Is it... did you have this trade test as
then
soon
as you arrived?
Then we
were issued with the uniforms and all this.
Was the trade test as soon as you arrived there, before you were assigned to the Fusiliers, or was it... When exactly did you take it?
Oh, well, I was first fitted out with my uniform and kit, you know, and then I was given the trade test early on, straight away. But I never heard any more about it, because I think they wanted bodies, not craftsmen and cutting things up with the chisels or sets or anything like that.
What was the full kit you were issued with, and what uniforms did you get?
Well, we got the ordinary uniform, boots, socks, trousers, underclothes, and you have a sack and pouches and all the full-blown uniform. You
didn't get any...
And a hat, which you had to watch out and made sure it fitted you.
You only got the one uniform, did you?
Only one uniform, yes.
And where were you at? You were at Blackdown Camp. What accommodation?
All the way through, we only had one uniform. Throughout the experience in the war, we only had one uniform. And if that got damaged or anything like that, or worn out or torn or anything, you had to replace it. You went to quartermasters and got it replaced.
What accommodation were you put in at Blackdown?
Huts and huts. There were already huts there. It's a good, proper military camp. You see, as it is now, still is.
What were the huts like?
There were long huts with a central stove, heating stove in the centre. That was the only heating, and of course they were all iron beds with the three biscuits, what we call biscuits, that were palliasses, you know, divided up into three, which of course you piled up and put tidy at the end of each day and first thing in the morning when you got up. And of course, the washing facilities were a bit primitive there. If you want to know about those, they were outside troughs with a tap at each end. And sometimes we had to, in one or two days of severe weather, we met while I was down there, we had to break the ice to wash. Mind you, it invigorated you because you were out in your singlet out there washing in the perishing cold, and then you had to run right round the square, and you were glad to do that to warm up, to get back and and get your billy can and draw your breakfast. And of course it was porridge as usual. And
what could you take me through the meals? What would you got porridge for breakfast?
Yeah, we usually got porridge for breakfast, you know, and you might have had a sausage and or something of that, or a bacon or something like that. And it wasn't bad. The food there was pretty good in England. The few months I was there at Blackdown, I never had any complaints at all.
What would you get for lunch usually, for dinner?
Well, sometimes you've got a cold meal like bully beef and hot potatoes and the usual thing, you know, and a bit of plum duff. And it was very ordinary and straightforward. There was no fancy meals at all. It was a good old-fashioned plain stuff that milk really put some... I was brought up on milk puddings and that, tapioca rice and all that. We got plenty of rice too there. And it was plain fare, but it was good. It was. I had no complaint about it. I only speak as I find.
Did you get a meal at tea time?
Yes, had tea. And if you wanted any after that, of course you got it at the Naffy canteen. There was just the three meals a day, breakfast, dinner and tea.
What would you buy from the Naffy canteen? What did they have to offer?
Oh, you had chocolate and cigarettes and all that kind of thing, you know, and there was a bar always laid on there, and whatever you wanted, there was a normal plain requirements, and if you wanted whiffs or anything like that, you could buy them, you know.
Whiffs?
Smoking. And there was no difficulties there, and so far as that Blackdown village itself, I mean, there was... we were in good... relationship with the shopkeepers and all that, because of course we used to buy stuff and all this kind of thing, you know, extra bits and pieces if we got enough money. And because it was sixpence a day then, you got, when I joined up.
How did you get on with the local civilians besides the shopkeepers?
All right, I didn't have much contact with them really, and what little we did have with them was, so far as I could see, quite cordial. There was no complaints about anything, except, of course, my mate, who was an orphan, and he'd got no father or mother, and no conscience either, really, Bill Fersk. He was the one who had his head blown off side of me on the 8th of August in the big push, the last one when we started the Germans hopping. And... of course, he was a proper daredevil. He got no question. He used to come out with me, and he amazed me on the first adventure that leaves an impression on my mind, where in the a big shop that was there with the shade hanging down, and on the bar across that supported the shade, they used to have officers' Burberrys hanging on coats various tunics and all that kind of thing. It was a military shop. They never used to deal with much civilian stuff there. And he used to calmly unhook an officer's Burberry, put it on, and hang the hanger up again and walk off down. I kept away from him because I was sure every minute they'd be chasing out the shop after him. But he never got caught.
What did he do with them? Couldn't take him back to
camp. He used to flog them. He flogged them afterwards. He didn't want them, you know. I don't think he'd ever... He'd always been a law unto himself, one of those kids, you know. Nobody ever bothered about him. I suppose he had to go his own gang, you know, his own way, and look after himself, which he did very well, I found.
He was your special friend
at the time,
I think.
Yes.
Is there anything else you can remember about him? I mean, while you were in England, not in France, so.
Well, he never had any relatives, he never had any letters, and he never seemed to care. He was a happy-go-lucky kid. He got no conscience, and anything, he raided the Naffy, and,
Did he tell you about that?
Oh, yes.
Can you remember what he said?
Well, I said, when you, how about, you suppose you get caught, he said, well, he said, oh, I'll be unlucky, won't I? You know, he just accepted that our fortune treated him, and treated him very well, as it happened, because when they brought these cigarettes back to the hut, of course, there was a report always put in, the complaint from the NAFI, that there'd been a raid and some of the lads had been pinching their cigarettes and various things. And, of course, there was a search they'd made of the hutch, you know, and they used to badge these things away, out of sight somewhere, even outside the hut, you know, where they could go and pick them up afterwards. And then they used to flog these. Only did it to get money, because they couldn't smoke all they pinched. They used to flog these, you know, cut price stuff, and of course they was always ready buyers, as you can guess.
How did
that was all part of the excitement of the camp, I suppose, you know.
How were these raids organised? How did he go about it?
He'd just get hold of somebody who prepared to go and say, "What about it? See if we can get some." He would get into the NAFI and get some fags or something of that, you see.
This would be when the NAFI was closed?
Oh, yes, after hours, you see. Because there was nobody resident in the NAFI. The place was locked up, you see, and left because there was no accommodation there for people to stay in. It was just like an ordinary hut converted into a store or a shop with the counter, and they used to serve the stuff and all that.
So he'd be after things like cigarettes, not the money or the takings.
Oh no, money was never it was, I think it was more the spirit of adventure that appealed to them, you know, or appealed to him. And I mean, it wasn't widespread. It was only spasmodic on occasions, you know, when I suppose they got a bit bored and people that used to like that kind of thing, and so there you are.
Well, how did you get on with the rest of now? You were put into the third.
That's right.
Battalion.
Yeah, then we went straight away into training.
Before we come to training, we might, as we've got on to, how did you get on with the people in your company? Which company were you in?
Oh God, I couldn't remember that.
How did you get on with the other ranks?
I think it was B Company I was in. All right, I always got on. I'm a good mixer. I've never worried about anybody and never let anybody worry me either. And, of course, you know, when they find that that you don't take any liberties, they leave you alone that way, and you get on all right.
Were they mostly of the same sort of background as yourself, or was there a mixture of backgrounds? How was the...
Oh, there was a mixture, you know. There's people sent there from other parts of the country. You know, southern England, obviously, because the north was looking after itself, and Wales and Scotland. But there, it was mainly from the London and surrounding districts. And, of course, London, not only a big place, but the surrounding areas, you know, and people like come from Tilbury would be sent there, or somewhere in Surrey or something like that, you see. But you've got all kinds there, and it wasn't until we got across the other side, we met the sort of the other nationalities, like the Welsh and the Scots. And
you say you got all kinds. Would they still be getting the sons of the rich, so to speak?
Like no. Mainly those border people went and got commissions.
So it wasn't like the early days of the war when you'd have a broad social mix. It was mainly people from working class backgrounds.
Oh yes, we were all. The Cockney whip was prevalent, you know, and it was one big joke, you know. You know how we all got together and nothing mattered. We didn't care a bugger, and that was it. And
can you tell me some of the sorts of things that you found funny? What sort of things did the Cockney humour pick on at the time? Any incidents or examples?
No, we didn't. I'll tell you why, mainly because the training was so intensive there that it was training from the time you got up in the morning and the time you packed up and off and you had your tea, sometimes you had to put in an hour in the classroom or something like that, you know, and be told the fine arts of infighting or street fighting or something like that.
If sticking to just how you got up, the humour would be mainly what was happening to you, rather.
Oh yes, it was day to day stuff, and you know, it was just the usual. As I say, Cockney wit is irrepressible. It always has been, and it was one big laugh, you know, because you were outdoing one another in your titbits and all this kind of thing. And
was there any bullying amongst the people, you know, was there that you noticed?
Any what?
Bullying.
No. No, I think it was a new world to all of us, you know, and most of us wanted to go, you know, go across and do some scrapping. You didn't want to mess about going round the parade ground and with heavy packs on a route march, you still, and you only had a 10-minute break and you was almost ready to, you know, drop on your feet sort of business, and it was tough. The old sweats were in charge, and they didn't. And we had
the
only bullies that you mentioned just now were the sergeant majors.
Well, we'll come to that. The NCOs then. How did you get on with the various NCOs? What did you think of them, and how did they treat you?
We accepted them because we couldn't do anything else. Mainly, it was the inevitability of war. You know that we'd teach you horrible lot, you know, this kind of thing that you got from the sergeant majors, and you laughed over it to yourself, but you didn't laugh while he was saying it, you know, the type of thing. It was a schoolmaster and his youngsters, you know, that was the attitude that was adopted, and we accepted it because we used to get a laugh out of the attitude of the sergeant major and his expressions and the way he used to, and the sergeants as well. They were all sweats, and they didn't spare any epithets of any kind. They just let it go, and you had to accept it. And
what about the corporals and lance corporals? How did you get on with them?
All right. But a lot of them were new to it that were made, you know. And I don't know what the basis was for selecting them. Some of us didn't want to hold any rank at all. We were happy, you know, to be just one of the privates and the lads, you know, and we just carried on. It was if you was a bit of a human, of a psychologist, you know, you could get a thorough kick out of it. I used to. The changes and all the different specimens of humanity that you met there, and everybody got a different outlook. Some of them didn't relish the idea at all. Of going abroad and fighting the Germans. Some of them didn't, you know, they weren't all eager like we were, you know. When I say we were, there was a number of us who just accepted it, and we wanted to have a go at Jerry, you know.
Were you all new recruits, or were there some people going back for the second time, or...?
No, all new recruits there. We never had any wounded who'd recovered or anything like that, really. When we got out there, we found them already out there.
Why would you have refused promotion to corporal? Why didn't you want it?
Well, it wasn't because I didn't want responsibility, but it was just because I had some friends there, and I was getting all right, quite happy with them, and I wanted to be with the boys.